Good morning, everyone. My name is Pete, and I am an alcoholic. Known as Irish Pete because I was born in London. that's where it all got messed up. But hope everyone can hear me. Can you all hear me back there? Good. I was actually born in London in a big Irish community in 1957, and it was a very interesting place to be born. If you were white, you were Irish, and most of the people I lived with were from the Caribbean or Africa, from India, and it was a very colorful place to grow up, and kind of wild place. We were all immigrants, and I was born into an Irish Catholic family. We didn't have much, but nobody had much back then, you know. I mean, nobody had a phone, nobody had a washing machine, very few people had a car. But, you know, we were happy, we were simple, and, you know, we didn't think we were poor. We'd make the pilgrimage to Ireland every year, across the Irish Sea. We got a train up to Wales and back to Holy Ireland, and that was where, you know, that was the place to be. That was where we were from. And so our culture was very strong, even though I spoke with a London accent back then. Going back to Ireland, sounded, they call you English. But I was like, that was an offense, because we never thought of ourselves as English. But so there was an identity crisis starting right there at the beginning. And I heard someone share in the rooms here recently about their experience in the birth canal, all the way back there. That's where it started. And I remember my mother telling me that I happened to be, when I got my birth certificate, it's got the Royal Borough of Kensington on it, which is not where I lived, because we lived in northwest London. It was a big immigrant community, as I said. But I said, well, why have I got Royal Borough of Kensington on my birth certificate? And she said, well, back then, the first child was always born at home. So, you know, I was expected to be born at home. But the problem was my mother was very short. That's where I get my height from. She was like 4'10" and very slim. She's still alive. She's 86, still 100 miles an hour. And she told me that my head was too big and I was the wrong way around. So they had to race me in to this midwife school where I was born. Found out years later it was actually the hospital where Jimi Hendrix was pronounced dead, which is kind of sad, but ironic. But yeah, so my head was too big and I was the wrong way around, and that's kind of been a lot of my problem for growing up. I went to school there. We had a little convent school, Catholic school. It was very strict, and I was always clowning around. I couldn't sit still in a chair. I'd probably be diagnosed with ADD now these days. Back then, we'd never heard of that. I just would wander around the school. I'd get whacked with a stick. Back in those days, you could do that, and kind of kept us in order. Not like these days. Not that I'm a proponent of that, but it didn't do me too much harm, I don't think. Alcohol was always in the picture. I mean, my dad was one of nine that stayed alive, and six brothers, and every one of them, my uncles, they all lived with us for periods. And sadly, there's only one of them left now. And I believe about four of them died from alcoholism. But back then, they always would say to me, Pete, I'll be taking you for your first pint. So to me, having my first pint was a ritual of growing up. And none of them ever did, because I had my first pint way before they got around to getting me to the pub, you know. And I remember tasting my first drop of alcohol. I mean, I'm sure I tasted it before then, but the one that stuck in my mind was at my grandparents' place, and there was a bottle of sherry, and my brother and I started swigging it under the table, and I got that nice warm feeling, and it stuck in my mind, but I didn't think anything too much of it. And every time we got back to Ireland, we'd always have these big get-togethers, usually for either a wedding or a funeral or something like that. So there'd be about 100 people there at the gatherings. And my father would always point out this uncle to me. And honestly, this is what my father would say. He'd just point out this uncle and he'd say, "That's your Uncle Paddy. He doesn't drink." And he'd leave it at that. And so in my mind as a kid was, there's something wrong with him, you know. And I didn't put the two and two together. I just hadn't got a clue. But anyway, here I am here today in Woodstock, Georgia. Now I'm going to jump ahead. I came into the rooms in December 31st, 1987, and everyone always says, why did you pick New Year's Eve, you know, as your sobriety date? And I tell them that date picked me. I never picked that date. That date picked me. But if anyone had said to me back then in 1987 that, you know, 35 years later I'd be here in Woodstock, Georgia, I would have said, you've got to be crazy. But if they'd have said to me, you're going to be in Woodstock, Georgia, and you wouldn't have had a drink for 35 years, I would have said, I might as well just top myself now, because that sounds really depressing. And so that's the way I was growing up. I loved the idea of drinking, and I got drunk. First time I remember getting drunk, I was about 12 at a party with some kids from school, and I went wild. I always seemed to just be the one that blacked out and went wild from day one. And I remember trying to fight this gang of guys. I was 12, these guys were 18, and I'm wanting to fight them all, you know. And you know, without drink, I never would have done anything like that, you know. And thinking of it afterwards, when people told me what happened, I was full of shame. And you know, I just thought, I didn't want to think about it, so the best way was to drink. And that became my habit, was just drink and forget about stuff. And drinking worked for me, you know, because I was always very anxious, and I was the eldest. I had a brother and two sisters, and so I always felt like I was had to be in charge. And around 1970, you know, my mother and father were like, it was like a battlefield growing up. I mean, my mother was a lot younger than my father. My father was very strict Catholic, very old-fashioned. I remember my mother getting a job. It was about 1964 or something like that. And she got this job. She was all excited. And Monday morning she went down to the job, and she came home, and I came home from school, and my mother's crying. And I was like, what's wrong? She said, your father told me I can't work. So she'd gone down to that job. My father had gone ahead of her and told the company, you're not going to take my wife. She isn't going to work. And that's the way my father was. He just was real old school that way, old fashioned. And so it was a battlefield. My mother was very, she didn't take that. She stood up against him. So it was like a war zone at home. There'd be stuff flying around. And there was one incident that in years later when I went for therapy, it was an incident that I used to laugh at. My mother would even tell people about it, and we'd all laugh at it. And I didn't realize the damage it had done to me until I went for deep therapy. And that's the great thing about these rooms, you know. We come in with one thing, and then I realized I had a whole bunch of other stuff I had to address. But I had to stop drinking first. I couldn't put the cart before the horse, because I couldn't address anything else until I put down the drink. So anyway, this incident, I must have been about 6, and maybe even younger, but I do remember it. There was a fight going on. We were all sick. It was a winter time. Everyone had a flu or something. And my father was trying to blame my mother for us all being sick. And he's like, there's not enough cabbage in this house. I remember him saying that. You're not eating enough cabbage. Anyway, my mother's trying to give me this syrup, this medication syrup. And I'm kind of didn't like the taste of it. And she's trying to argue with my father. And she got so upset, she poured the flipping syrup over my head. I remember it all coming down over my head. And, you know, I used to laugh at that. But years later, when I went to therapy, I was asked to think about that. And what did I learn? What message did I get from that incident? And the message was that if a woman's angry, I'm going to get hurt. And that was a bad thing for me to, message for me to get. Because in years later, it caused me to be violent. And anyway, I went on, as I'll go back to my lineage story now, linear. So 1970, as I said, the trouble in the family, my mother and father were like a war zone. I was already out working at the age of 11, 12, getting my own money. I had a paper stand. I used to sell newspapers. I used to help the milkman in the morning. And so I felt independent because I knew in my head, these folks can't look after me. I'm going to have to look after myself. So I was on the streets. I was learning from guys on the streets. And I was doing good. And then in the middle of it all, I was 13 years of age. My mother decided to leave, went off with another man. My father just took us all and we all moved back to Ireland. So at 13, I'm taken out of London, where I had all my security and all my own setup, and I'm dropped in the middle of Dublin. And I don't know if you know, in 1970, 71 is when the troubles in Ireland were starting to get really bad. And going into Dublin with a London accent was not a good place to be. And so I kind of got rid of that pretty quick, most of it anyway. But it was tough. I mean, London was pretty violent where I grew up. I mean, there was a lot of violence. I mean, in school, you could never look anyone in the eye. You had to always walk down looking at the ground. There'd always be someone kicking you or banging you on the back of the head. That's just the way it was, and I was used to that. In Dublin, I remember my first day walking out in the neighborhood that we moved into, and this guy comes up to me. He says, "Where are you from?" And I told him. He hits me right in the stomach, like as hard as he could. Next minute, we're fighting each other, and I managed to get on top of him. I was so angry that this guy had hit me, and he said, okay, you're a good goer, and he shakes my hand, and he's like, that was your path of passage, was you had to be able to fight. And it was horrible because, you know, I couldn't go anywhere without gangs and being chased and fighting and violence, and it was not a nice way to grow up. But I found a group of guys down in the inner city, and their Friday nights were spent, you know, buying as much alcohol as you could and going sitting by the canal and just getting drunk. And this was great for me. This is what I wanted to do. And sounds really depressing, but we had great laughs there. You know, we just get down. We were all about 13, 14 years of age, and that's what we do. And so I quit school, 14 years of age, I quit school. I got a job. My first job was in a big store in Dublin. You had to be 15. I was nearly 15 when I quit. But anyway, they let me in there and gave me employment. It's full of ups and downs. I was operating an elevator. That was my job. Anyway, that's true. But you know, my head, I've heard someone say, I think it was Adam, said he had a criminal mind. And that's the way mine was, you know. It was like I was always looking, how could I fiddle this, how could I fiddle that. So I had a friend of mine who worked across in a dry cleaners. He was one of my buddies who we used to go drinking with. And so we figured out that this elevator went up to the stock room once it went left the sales floors. And I'd be getting a bag or whatever they had there, leaving it in the elevator, and he'd come in and take it. This went on for ages, and we'd sell everything and make a lot of extra money. But anyway, they finally caught me. They actually didn't catch me. They knew there's something going on, and I got fired. So, you know, I just ended up getting another job. But I used to count my money back then and how many pints I could get on a Friday. This is at 15, 16 years of age. So, you know, it was like by the age of 16, I was drinking alcoholically. And I remember going, and you could get into a bar at 15, 16 in Dublin back in those days, and there's no, we didn't have IDs, you know, so just depended on how you looked. And once you didn't cause any trouble, you were fine. So, you know, I'd get into a bar, and I remember there was someone had left this AA literature in this bar, the questionnaire. I'd heard of AA maybe seen on TV, but I really didn't know anything about it. And I did the questionnaire, and I'm like, my God, according to this, I'm an alcoholic. And I'm telling all the guys and laughing. So this is, because I answered yes to pretty much everything. And never thought about it after that. I just thought that was ridiculous. Because back in Ireland, an alcoholic, in my mind, was the guys I used to see in the gutter or in the doorways, you know, completely wet brains. And that, to me, was an alcoholic. I didn't know that they never started. I thought they were born there like that. You know, I didn't realize there was a passage to get there. And I always tell this story because it kind of sums up the way I thought. And there were these two women in Dublin who were at a funeral. The wife is burying her husband, and as the coffin's going down into the grave, her friend says to her, or she says to her friend, she says, "It was the drink that killed him." And her friend says, "Did he not try AA?" And she said, "Oh no, he wasn't that bad." And you see, and that's the way my thinking was. I wasn't that bad, because I always compared myself to the guys I was with, and I wasn't as bad as the guy in the doorway, you know, on the street. And in Dublin in those days, you'd see a lot of that, you know. I mean, real guys with wet brains, sadly, you know, when you get that far down in the elevator, you can't even press the button to get off, you know. But anyway, my drinking, blackouts, that was the pattern. As I had more money, I was able to get more drink. But I was very depressed. I was very fed up. It was a boring life. I ended up working in factories, construction work, and I knew there had to be something better. And I realized, man, I need to go back to school or something. I can't be doing these dead-end jobs. I was looking at guys in their 30s that were bent over, you know what I mean? And I thought, this is going to kill me. So thankfully, I got back into school at the age of 18 to study to be a radio officer in the Merchant Navy. And that's what I want to do. I thought, I'll go out to sea. I'll get and study this. It was a four-year course. You needed to have your over there, they have the equivalent of a GED, but then you could have 2 years after that, you do your leaving cert. So you had to have that level. I didn't even have my GED. But back then, before the internet, there was not a lot of stuff on record. But I don't know how I got in, but I think my higher power must have been looking after me. But anyway, I had to work twice as hard as everyone else, because I just had very little knowledge in math and English and everything else. And I used to be in the library every night doing these self-help books. And I'm like, why didn't they give me this in school? This is easier than the way those teachers used to explain it to me. But anyway, I ended up coming second top in the class and did really well. I didn't do the final year. After 3 years, I got a job with the cable TV in Dublin. I pretty much had enough of studying at that point. And I was working. My life seemed to be on a good track. I got to a point where I was disillusioned with the way I was living, and I started to seek spiritual things. And I think the book talks about that in some place. I can't remember where it is, but it talks about vague spiritual yearnings, and that's what it was for me. I was like, there's got to be something better than this life. And I remember being in the pub one day, and you know, in the summer in Ireland, it stays light till about 11 o'clock at night, and I've been drinking all day, and I come out of the pub, it's about 10:30, it's still light, and I see this guy walking up the street with no shoes on, and he's got long hair, and I'm like, that's Jesus. I'm thinking in my head, and I go over and start talking to him, and I'm he's real happy, and he's probably stoned out of his head, but you know, I'm starting to get into all this weird kind of stuff, because I didn't accept life on its terms, and I thought, I got to get into something better than this. So anyway, I started thinking maybe I'll become a priest, and I thought I'll study for that. And of course, this celibacy thing, it was like, man, I can't do that. So, you know, I forgot about that part, you know. So I thought, man, the Protestants have it a little better. Maybe I'll just become a Protestant and, you know, get away with it that way. But anyway, I did get into studying the Bible, and I got in with a little group studying. This was around the time U2 and all that were coming big in Dublin, and they were in the same kind of group, actually, that I was in. And it was interesting, you know. There was a lot of new things for me to learn about, because I didn't learn about a lot of all the things the Protestants learned about. I never learned about that stuff. We were told if you went into a Protestant building, you'd go to hell, and this was what I was taught, you know. But anyway, it did help me get on a bit of a straight path for a while. I was still drinking, but I wasn't drinking as much. I'd gotten into having wine with my food, but I was still drinking a whole bottle of wine with my food, but that to me wasn't drinking, that was my eating. And you know, I didn't even think about it that in the same frame, you know. So I was always had a bit of a buzz, you know. And anyway, but it kept me straight. I was able to finish my studies. I got this job. And then everything kind of fell apart. And my job packed in. There was no work in Ireland. This was about 1980. My parents decided to move back to England. My father got a job there. I'd actually come out to America to visit these people that I'd met in Dublin. 1979, I came out here to Philadelphia. And I had a great time. And when I came back, the house is empty. There's a bed and a dresser there and a note saying, "Pete, we've sold the house. The people are moving in about 4 weeks. Can you stay here for 4 weeks? We left you the bed and everything." I'm like, what the fuck? And anyway, so, you know, normally we leave home when we're 21, but my folks left me when I was 21. They all moved. My brother was in the military. He'd gone in the military. I had a sister who'd gone in to study nursing, and my younger sister went with my parents. Anyway, I was fine, you know. I managed to move in with some friends, and but it was my job. I'd lost my job at that time. Everything went downhill. So I'd learned guitar in my unemployment days, and so I went from being like a career focused to playing guitar out in the streets and just partying every night. I mean, with this group of guys, and we all lived in this in a government housing in Dublin, in a really rough part of Dublin. But if you played an instrument there, everyone took care of you. Nothing ever happened to your stuff. No one broke into your house or nothing. But you know, so I'd go out at lunchtime when there was a crowd. I'd wake up about 11, go out there, play during the lunchtime, make enough money, go out when people are going home, work, and then we go party every night. And this went on for about a year more, and it becomes depressing after a while, because everyone's just out of their head. And I thought, man, I got to get out of here. Anyway, I ended up getting disillusioned with the religious stuff, with the folks I was with, and I thought, I'm just going traveling. And I got the courage up. I went down, traveled, left Ireland, went around Spain. Anyway, long story, I'm traveling around in Greece. I'm partying, I'm meeting people. You know, the thing is, when you go out and do stuff on your own, you end up meeting people of like mind. And I met some great travelers. But I had a month ticket to get around Europe, and I ended up down in Greece, and I was fed up of being on trains after about 3 weeks of being on trains. So I go out to Crete, and I meet these ladies from Montreal, and we're having a great party. We're drinking and come back to Athens, and I'm sitting down at the table having a few drinks with some Australian guys and English guys, and they're like, "Well, where are you going next, Pete?" And I'm like, "Man, where am I going?" I looked at my ticket. I had 2 days to get back to Dublin. I'm like, "Well, I ain't going to make it back to Dublin." So the Australian guy says, "Well, Pete, if you get a plane here, $50, you'll be in Tel Aviv. You can get to work on these farms out in Israel. And you work for 3 months, you'll be able to go down and see the pyramids and head back to Ireland for Christmas." And I thought, man, that sounds like a plan. So next day, I buy my $50 ticket. I end up in Israel. And I'm like, here I was running away from God, and I end up in Israel. anyway, I get sent to this farm out in the middle of flipping West Bank. I got barbed wire around me. I got tanks. I'm like, my God, I left Ireland, and I'm in this place. But anyway, I did my 3 months, got my money, went down to the border with Egypt. You had to travel through the Sinai in those days to get to Egypt. I get robbed on the border. And so I didn't make it over into Egypt. And all I had was my clothes I had on, a bit of money that I used to keep around my neck, my passport and that. And I meet these two Scottish lads on the beach, and I told them, they're like, "Man, yeah, people rob you down here." So anyway, they said, "Well, stay with us. We're going on to a kibbutz." And I'd never heard of it. I knew what a kibbutz was, but I'd never been on one. And they said, "It's much better than what..." I'd been on this cooperative farm, which was much harder work, and I was working 7 days a week there, but this kibbutz was like party life. I mean, you did six days a week, 6 hours a day, and the rest of the time you were just partying with all these people from all over the world. So, man, that was just right down my alley. And anyway, we get sent up to this place up by the Sea of Galilee, and I had my guitar, we played. It was just a great life, but I'm just getting into the drinking much more heavier spirits, and it was like a constant hangover. And anyway, believe it or not, 2.5 years went by before I got back to Dublin. And I went back briefly one summer, and it was so horrible, the hunger strikes were going on. I went straight back out to Israel. And it was, I planned on staying there. I moved to another area down south near Gaza. And I got a letter one day from my father saying that my sister was getting married and I had to get back for the wedding. And I was kind of sad because I hated to have a deadline. I just wanted irresponsibility. That's what I thought responsibility was going to trap me, you know, make me feel trapped and claustrophobic. But I found out years later, and I remember talking with Damon about this, responsibility set me free. But it took the rooms and me stopping drinking to really understand that. But yeah, I ran away from responsibility. And so when I get this letter, it's like, man, I got to be responsible. I got to show up at my sister's wedding. So anyway, I managed to get the money together and went back for the wedding, which was close to Christmas time. It was November 1983. So I thought, I'll go back to London, I'll go to this wedding, and then I'll go back to Ireland for Christmas, have a nice party, and then head back out to Israel. And everything went to plan until I got to Ireland and met a lady who ended up being my first wife. And the reason she became my first wife was, you know, she got pregnant. And with my daughter now, who lives in Dublin still, who's got 4 kids now. Yeah, not it gets boring over there in Ireland, I tell you. There's not much else to do. I was there in Ireland, same old thing, back to the playing music and partying. But then I've got a lady pregnant, and I felt I had to marry her because I was afraid. I was full of guilt. I didn't want her to have an abortion because I couldn't live with that. It was all about me. Anyway, she was only 18, 19. I was 25, 26. And we got married. So I've gone from bumming around, living on beaches out in the Middle East, 1983. By 1985, I've got 2 kids. I bought a house. I got my own business going because no one would give me a job. I started a carpet cleaning business. And from the outside, everything looked great. And I'd have people coming up to me saying, man, Pete, you fall into a bucket of shit and you come out with a suit on, you know? And, but it wasn't, it was inside, I was struggling. There was so much anxiety. Alcohol was my solution because it was only when I could drink is when I'd feel at peace, you know, for a short period. And then I couldn't just drink like that and stop, you see. It was always that line that I'd go over. And I'd end up in a blackout, waking up in a strange place, not coming home for a few days. So, you know, you can't really be married and live like that. And sure enough, I remember my 30th birthday was December of my sobriety, 1987. And my ex-wife, my first wife at the time, gave me a surprise party. And it was great. A lot of old friends there, and I felt like on top of the world, you know. It was like, man, things have been great. And I really did feel good in this surprise party. And little did I know, 10 days later, everything collapsed, you know. And it was over that Christmas. There was party after party after party. I was so looking forward to the break because I worked hard, and I was looking forward to just drinking for the whole week. And that's what I did. And that last party, I remember being at the party, been drinking all day. They'd run out of a lot of drink, this bottle of Southern Comfort. I'd never drank that before in my life. And that was all that was there. So I'm drinking that out of the bottle. That was my last drink, Southern Comfort. Maybe there was a message there. That's true. That's interesting. But I remember dancing with my wife's friend, and next minute we're on the floor, and next minute I hear my wife shouting in my ear saying, you bastard. And you know, I shut up out of it and realized I'd gone into another blackout, and I thought I was in a hotel room, you know. But anyway, that was the end of it, because that wasn't the first time I had to tell my wife that I cheated. So I woke up the next morning. I went back to the house with this friend of hers, which caused, you know, I remember plates flying everywhere and holes in the wall. The police came. But anyway, all I remember the next day, waking up on the bed, Christmas tree knocked over, holes in the wall, like I said, plates smashed, my wife and kids gone. And she went down to my mother's. So I had the phone rang, and it was my friend Paul, who I used to drink with, and he disappeared for about 3 months. I hadn't seen him. I'd seen him a couple of times, and he was drinking water with me. And I'm like, why are you drinking water? And he never told me, because it made me feel real uncomfortable going out for a few drinks, and he's drinking water. And I notice that these days now, when I'm drinking water and people are uncomfortable, that's a sign. You know? If they're not uncomfortable, they're normal. But you know, but I was very uncomfortable. And he said to me, Pete, I heard what happened last night. He said, look, you got to come to a meeting with me. And I said, a meeting? So at that point, I would have done anything. If he'd have said, you got to come sit in a bucket of shit, I would have done it. You know, I had that gift of desperation at that point. So I went down to that meeting with him, and it was in an old tenement building in Dublin. Went upstairs, and I'll never forget it. There was a priest there was a nun there. I always thought they were spies. I thought they were spying on us, but they were there. And, but you know, I got a message there. I got a message of hope that's never left me. And I saw people there that I'd known on the streets of Dublin who I knew were crazy. And there they were talking about their feelings, talking about what was going on inside them. That scared me, because I never looked inside. I could never say how I felt, because I really didn't want to look. And when people would ask me how you're feeling, I never knew how to answer that question. Sad, mad, glad, that was all I knew, you know. And but seeing these people there like that, clean and full of joy and just happy, and being able to talk in depth and talking about spiritual things, and that never scared me away, because I always believed in God. I just thought I was God, really, when it came down to it. You know, that's the old saying I said, the only difference between me and God is that God doesn't wake up every morning thinking he's Pete. But the thing was, that hope, like I say, never left me. So they said, you know, get 90 meetings in 90 days. And, you know, I noticed while I was in the rooms, the shaking stopped. So I was getting 2, sometimes 3 meetings a day, and hoping that my wife and kids would come back, you know. And after a month, they still hadn't come back. And I was still going to the meetings, still working with a sponsor. And then after about 6 weeks, 7 weeks, her uncle, one of my wife's uncles, big guy, came up to the house, knocked at the door, and he said, she wants to come home. And I said, well, she's welcome to come home. He said, yeah, but you got to get out. And I knew her uncles. She had a bunch of uncles that I knew that if I didn't get out, I could be floating down in that River Liffey. So I said, okay. I said, give me a couple of weeks. I'll get my stuff and I'll get out. And I was really angry, you know. I thought, man, got to get out. How can I run my business? And I knew there was no point talking to this guy. He didn't listen. So I sold the business. I left half the money. I cleaned up the house, packed up my van that I had, and I said, I'm going to have to go to London because I know I'll get work there. I've got to pay the bills. So my sponsor says, Pete, look, if you're going to go, he said, I don't recommend you do anything for the first 6 months, make these major decisions. I said, yeah, but you don't know what I'm dealing with. I'm going to be dead if I wait 6 months. And but you know, that was me, panic, anxiety. I know what's best. Anyway, he said to me, look, once you get to London, make sure you get to a meeting, pick up that phone straight away. So I got over to London. 1 day, 2 days went by, I still hadn't gone to a meeting, and the shakes are starting to come back. And I knew if I went to a pub, I'd meet some more Irish people and I'd feel at home. And I thought, I was so tempted. It got to the 3 day mark, and I thought, why am I not picking up the phone? And I realized by that time I'd a Dublin accent, and the English would always make fun of the Irish. And I thought, man, these English guys are going to make fun of me talking. I thought, what the hell, I'm just going to pick up the phone. I picked up the phone, went to this meeting. Half the meeting was Scottish and the other half was Irish, so it really didn't matter. But I got involved somewhat. I was still on the edge. I still was doing it to try and get my kids and wife back. And I thought, in my mind, I'm thinking, I'll get them back and then I can go back out drinking like a gentleman, like I always did. But, you know, so we tried counseling. I used to go back to, I landed a great job. I tell you, my higher power is amazing how he always has opened up things for me in that area. And I would pray. I still didn't have an idea of how God worked in my life and what, step three, what that really meant. I'm still working out step three now. It is a one-time decision, but it takes a whole lifetime to work out. That's the great thing about this program and Facebook, because now I've found more people I need to make amends to that I thought were gone. But, but you know, like I say, I used to go back to Ireland. I'd get long weekends. I'd finally get to see my kids every little, by that time I had my daughter and my son. They were very young. And my wife was using them to punish me, which, you know, I can understand now. But one time I took 2 weeks off. It was around the September time. So I was about 9 months into sobriety. And, I went over to Ireland and I got to see my kids for 2 afternoons. And I was with my friend Paul, who brought me into the fellowship. And after the second visit, I'm walking down. I got 1 day before I fly back to London. And I was in autopilot. And I'm walking down my main street, really sad, because I'd only seen my kids for 2 afternoons. And I went to go into my local bar. The bar that, it was downstairs. I remember so many experiences in that bar. One thing I didn't talk about, when I go in there and they tell me I was barred because of what I did the night before, and I'm like, what the hell did I do? Those horrible feelings. But anyway, they always let me back. And this was my local. And I went to go in there. My friend Paul grabbed me by the arm and he said, Pete, what are you doing? And I said, yeah, what am I doing? Finally, I was starting to get a bit of clarity in my head. I was starting to get in touch with Pete and starting to like Pete. And I thought, you know what, wife or no wife, kids or no kids, I need to do this for me. And that's when I had that crossroads and I started on the path for myself. And that was a great experience. But I still didn't want to get in and do the work. I was still afraid of step 4 and 5. And even though I'd gone through it with my sponsor in Dublin, I hadn't got a clue what I did. I went through it again at a Joe and Charlie meeting back in 1990. I remember going to that. That was a fantastic weekend. But eventually I got this sponsor. They always said to me, stick with the winners. But I didn't know who the winners were. You know, to me, the winners were the ones with the fancy cars, you know. But that's not always the case. Sometimes it's the old guy with the dog who has a limp, who's content. And, you know, and I mistook that. And I didn't always pick the winners. And I had some crazy sponsors. But you know what? They were there at the right time. And I got what I needed to learn from them. Because we're all crazy. I'm here because I'm not all there, you know, still. But we're coming close, so I'm going to have to get up. But anyway, I finally, after 3 years, I got the sponsor. I got told to jump into the middle of the bed instead of being on the edge. And that's when my program took off for me. Because I volunteered to lead a meeting. Back in London in those days, you had to take a 6-month commitment. So you said you're going to lead that meeting, you had to do it for 6 months. So people got to know your face and you got involved. And as my sponsor said, I got into the middle of the bed. And then I was on the 12-step call out list and I was going out picking up people. Man, I see miracles. Because back in those days, you know, the phones were still attached to the wall and you still had to, people didn't always have cars. So you had to go drive and pick people up and bring them to the meeting. And it was great because you got to really close with these people. And I remember one in particular, and I'll share this because it was one of the biggest miracles I've seen. And I remember picking up this guy who was living in a public toilets, public restroom in a park. And he stunk. And he got in my car and the smell in my car. I thought, man, how am I going to pick up a girl now after this? But it took about 2 weeks to get rid of that smell. But anyway, I got him down to the meeting and I thought, man, that poor guy. And I heard him, you know, I saw him a couple of days later. He was still in a bad way. And then I lost touch with him. And it was about a year later, I'm at a meeting in another area of London, and he's telling his story. And this guy used to be a high-powered bank manager in the city of London. and he went through a divorce, and he everything just fell, and he ends up living in the toilet. But and he said his rock bottom was when he was getting a cigarette butt out of the urinal to smoke, and a flash of light came from the sun through the window and hit him. And you know, it was just amazing to see a year later the change in this guy. That was pretty dramatic. I mean, but I've seen a lot of people change and a lot of miracles in this program. But you know, it took me a long time to get my head right, because I learned the hard way. And after 1992, I got married again to a lady from America. That's how I ended up out here. We ended up having three more kids, going through two divorces, because I married again the second time against everybody's advice. But anyway, she left 2009. She decided to leave again, and I had the three kids on my own, and I focused on raising those kids. And I'd be sitting here in these rooms, going through these divorces. It was really tough. But a divorce is a great place to teach you to let go, you know. And God had to do that for me three times. You see, it's pretty stubborn, and you know, you have to just be patient, and you just have to do the right thing. And then you just let go, because otherwise you'd go crazy. And I'd have people who would be sent to me at work, because I never would hide my story. I'd always tell people. Once I'd got a few years sobriety, in the early days, anonymity for me was very important, because I couldn't handle the backlash, people calling me an alcoholic. But now it doesn't matter. But anonymity is a blessed, precious thing. And anyway, I went through those two divorces, and in 2009, the kids and me were just on our own, and I focused on getting them through school, and I got the job done, and it was some good times. And the age of 59, I had them all out of the house, and they were all trying to fix me up. They thought, Dad's lonely, we need to get him fixed up with a woman. And my girls especially would try and fix me up with their mother's friends. And anyway, I had a lot of sponsees. My life was busy. I got back into playing my sport when I got sober, and I played a lot of soccer. I'm still playing. I got to run off and play a game now today after this meeting. But anyway, 59, that was what, 2017, I finally met the love of my life, and she just walked into the room there now. That's great. And we got married a year later. And I never thought my 60s would be my best decade. But hey, it's got better. Each one has got better. So I'm really enjoying life right now because of this program, because of what God has done through you people. These rooms have really helped me have a wonderful life right now. Now, life ain't perfect. There's always stuff. Life will throw curveballs. Last year, I nearly died. I ended up having a stroke after thinking I was one of the fittest guys around, playing soccer three or four times a week. And it turned out I had a 90% blocked artery. And they thought it was due to my years of smoking, which I did smoke quite a bit. But so this stuff was still catching up with me. But thanks be to God, it all fixed up, and I'm back out playing again. But you know, we're not promised anything. We've got this moment, this day. Those who are just coming back today, thank you. You bless me. Really do. Because this is what it is, a day at a time. You know, all my days have added up, and it really doesn't matter, because today is what matters, you know, this moment. And it's great to be able to share this moment with you guys. Thanks for listening to me. Hope I see more of you again. Great to see some old faces hadn't seen for a long time. But thank you for listening to me. Thanks, David.